past quarter century or so, no particular issue in the area of food and the food system has generated perhaps as much attention as genetically modified organisms in food. What we're going to do today in food toxicology is actually try to introduce what GMOs are in food and talk a little bit stray perhaps from what we've done previously in the course. We'll stray into the social ramifications, perhaps the bioethical ramifications of GMOs in food, as well as the scientific and regulatory science associated with GMOs in food. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to do is we're going to try to understand the background, a little bit of the history of the GMO in food debate. We're not going to try and take sides here. There's a very passionate debate on both sides of the issue. We're going to try to identify some of the underpinning sensitivities associated with this global issue. We're going to try to explore the range of crops and foods that currently do contain GMOs in the marketplace. We're going to try to survey some of the current trends in GMO foods and their future implications not only for the food, but also for the science of biotechnology. We're going to try to understand some of the U.S. advances in regulatory controls for GMO foods, and we're going to try to review some of the early genetic engineering of generally recognized as safe ingredients in foods. We're going to try to review some recent incidences of GMOs in food. Some mishaps, if you will, and some successes. And we'll also try to look at U.S. and international policies, again, focusing mostly on the U.S. and the EU in terms of GMOs in food and their policies. In terms of GMOs in food, it's been the result of advances in biotechnology. What we found in the past several decades is that biotechnology advances in the laboratory have yielded some new tools that allow us to change what we have referred to as the fundamental molecules of life. What this does is it allows for engineering some desired genetic traits in plants, animals, and microbes in a very similar way that we have modified plants and livestock through various traditional breeding programs over the past century or so. We do, in biotechnology, have some new concerns about bioethics. And these are coupled with the debate of public health risks versus benefits, and we'll explore these as well. And some of the environmental risks and benefits, and we won't explore these in deep consequence here in this particular lecture. In terms of the products of biotechnology, we have genetically modified organisms, and these organisms are various plants, animals, and microorganisms, and that can be bacteria or viruses that we might want to change to suit particular needs. And we've changed these genetic characteristics to artificially give them a new property. Some of those new properties in terms of what's being done in the laboratory, whether it be research laboratories in academia, research in terms of corporate science, some of these end products include enhanced resistance of plants to disease and insects, some improvement in a nutritional value like a vitamin level in a particular crop, such as golden rice, increase crop productivity, plant tolerance in terms of herbicide applications, so you've got the ability to use softer or safer agricultural chemicals across a broader range of crops, and as well functional food enhancement in terms of programs like the development of edible vaccines in food products. Now, recall in our discussions, we've reviewed, at least from a bacterial point of view, the molecules of life to give you a sense of the numbers, the diversity, the range of molecules that might be changed in genetic engineering. Obviously, in genetic engineering, we're going to be changing the single DNA molecule in terms of reproductive capacity, but this will yield other changes, including changes in the plant or animal's RNA, yielding perhaps a diversity or a change in output, for example, of proteins. These can be enzymatic changes, proteins that have different sort of properties or components, such as the expression of a protein like BT toxin, an endotoxin in Bacillus thuringiensis that is used in terms of the genetic engineering of some crops. Now, in terms of the bioethics of biotechnology, you can approach this from many different directions in terms of the fundamental principles of what's going on in this national and international debate. Some people have an issue that perhaps we are playing God. Should we be doing this, dealing with these fundamental molecules of life, changing the essence of what organisms are in a very fundamental way? Are we opening perhaps a Pandora's box, perhaps with cataclysmic results in terms of breeding crops that become later super weeds that we can't control? Should we have some compassion or empathy for the new life forms, these engineered animals, or in some cases, humans? We are using biotechnology in terms of clones and gene therapy in humans for medical reasons. Is this an issue that we are going down a slippery slope where we can design super beings, whether it be plants, animals, or humans? What happens to the rest of us, the common plants, the biodiversity in the background? How do we balance risks? Are the potential gains, even if they are recognizable gains in medicine, the food supply, and the control of biology, is it worth the loss of innocence, the fact that we just know too much and are doing too much to nature around us, the loss of biodiversity, potential for cataclysmic results, again, like superweeds? Are there shades of gray that we need to be concerned about, that we are entering the region where it's a slippery slope? If one attribute in a plant or animal or human is good, are more better? And then finally, man's inhumanity to man. In our history, we found that every new technology necessitates a new war, is one quote I read. We've already seen in terms of terrorism that and some of the warnings of terrorism that perhaps bioengineering of new microbes or viruses is on the horizon, pathogens that will defeat any sort of medical therapy to control them in the human population. In terms of biotechnology, we also have a legal dilemma. If you have seen this, some of these plants, crops that have been bioengineered have been patented. Now, if you recall, in terms of the patent system and patent protection, these are for products which are new or novel, they're non-obvious, and there is a concept of substantially different, the novelty aspect, not substantially equivalent. And we'll see where that argument of substantial equivalence actually is a bit of a circular argument in the legal dilemma associated with the GMO interaction in the food system. In terms of biotechnology, in recent histories, we've found that it has had a bit of a troubling start. Some of the initial high-profile products were actually designed to help farmers and not necessarily have a direct consumer impact. These benefits included enhanced pest control, weed control. And so in terms of the consumers who are essentially being faced with these food products potentially entering the market system, the question was, what's in it for me? And at that point in time, the general public understanding was perhaps not too very much. It's making things easier for farmers. We've had a tremendous amount of biotechnology inserted into the pharmaceutical arena, for instance, the development of bacterially generated insulin in terms of diabetic therapy. However, general consumers aren't really aware of the interface of biotechnology and medicine in the same way, in the same sensitivity that they are with their daily diet. There is perhaps also a problem in terms of the trust us dictum of research and regulatory authorities, because in several highly publicized incidents, there were some perhaps loss of faith in terms of the public with the scientific and regulatory community. The first of these was the appearance of the Terminator gene generated by Monsanto, a very troubling for many people in terms of bioethics, a troubling development. This particular gene allowed the seeds from the progeny plant of biotechnology to actually be sterile. In other words, a farmer could not use those seeds again. in terms of agriculture and especially developing country agriculture, the ability of to use seeds from one crop to essentially seed or start the crop next year is an important part of historical agriculture. This was giving a corporate control to agriculture that you would have to go back to the vendor every year and buy new seed. In terms of another high profile incident, in 2000, there was an observation of Starlink, Bacillus thuringiensis modified corn that was regulated to be only in animal feed products, and it was found to have entered the human food chain. And we'll discuss this particular incident in detail. Now, about the same time as this was happening in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, some hazard data started appearing. This was also high profile. Cornell University scientists produced a study that 44% of monarch butterflies grown near with BT corn pollen had a significant lethality. There was also some British reports that GM potatoes inhibit rat growth and damage their immune system. Both of these have been challenged in terms of the scientific arena, the back and forth of appropriateness of this data. But even still, the fact that biotech did have some negative impacts was appearing on the public's plate, so to speak. Now, this was countered by the biotechnology industry, recognizing that, in fact, they had not been sensitive enough to consumers' interests in the quality of their food, that in dealing with things like pest control and some other issues in terms of herbicide resistance, enhanced insect resistance. The development of what is referred to as golden rice, rice that has enhanced with vitamin A, which is deficient in many countries around the globe. This goodwill, and I'll call it a public relations effort as well, in earnest, you have to give these companies credit. They essentially gave the licensing and capability to develop this crop and grow it away to the world's peoples for free. And so this was a response from a major biotech company that, in fact, this is the promise of biotechnology and genetically modified organisms in food. Now, some of the concerns that we have with GMOs in terms of a broad segment of society, there are questions about food safety, there's questions about control of food supply. If we have a company that is doing things like terminator genes, what's their real approach in terms of controlling the food supply? Are we going to have our food totally vertically integrated in the hands of one, two, or three companies, international global companies? In terms of environmental impacts, are we going to develop these super monocultures, only one type of corn, only one type of soybeans, and lose the biodiversity that has helped us in terms of controlling against emerging pests, emerging illnesses or plant diseases, for example? Is there a biodiversity risk via interbreeding? That once this gene has entered the genomic trait of a species, is there going to be interbreeding across species that will allow for essentially a contamination, a genetic contamination, and loss of perhaps wild types out in the natural world? Are there going to be non-target impacts? For example, with BT toxin, will beneficial insects also be impacted, such as the monarch butterfly? And then there's also the nightmare scenarios, gene hopping, transgenic monsters, all of the things perhaps a little bit more of fancy, but in terms of appropriate risk assessment, people have been concerned about this. For example, the development of herbicide-resistant genes for the brassica plant species was actually discarded early on because there are many weeds in the brassica family, and the idea that although you might develop this for a crop, we might get some gene hopping, and that herbicide resistance would be a disaster in terms of controlling weeds out there in agricultural environments. There's also, from a public perspective, a fear of the unknown. What is biotechnology? How does it happen? From a public perspective, this is relatively high science. It's hard, perhaps, to translate what scientists are doing, what the controls are that are in place. The fact that, from the public perspective, it's not a natural process gives many reason for pause, as well as just the whole issue of, I like my food the way it is, why do we have to change this, and is this change an overall improvement? In terms of some of the promises of GMOs, there are many. The more abundant and healthy food in terms of enhanced nutrient capability, less dependence on chemical pesticides, if in fact you engineer the natural chemical defenses of a plant better or differently. Decreased production risk to farmers in terms of damage from pests and disease, therefore higher yields, greater food for a world that perhaps doesn't have sufficient food resources. Again, the other environmental positive is more agricultural yield per land mass to feed this growing hungry world. Right now, we are losing our rainforests and we are farming marginally arable land for short periods of time. We have issues of encroachment of desert sands in many parts of the world, including China, because of agricultural misuse of lands. We find that in terms of GMO, genetic modified changes in plants, we can be more precise than traditional breeding in terms of breeding in or changing the plant organism to have desirable characteristics without introducing non-desirable characteristics, like enhancing the natural toxins that occur in the particular plant that may arise from traditional breeding. And then the idea of the efficient production of life-saving medicines. Again, insulin is perhaps the greatest example of this. Now, in terms of the GMO debate, many issues have surfaced. How are we going to test these new products for their food safety? We've learned throughout the course here in food toxicology that the interaction of humans and their food system can actually bring on foodborne disease from chemical changes. Sometimes these are allergies. If a patent is for novel products and a GMO food developer is essentially claiming substantial equivalence, that this is potato is the same as an old style bred potato, what does that mean? Because in fact it is perhaps genetically not equivalent, but in terms of the overall properties of the potato, it is substantially equivalent. Another area of GMO debate is coexistence with traditional crops. If we have cross-pollination, are we going to limit ourselves in terms of growers and the consuming public that have, if nothing else, a preference for non-GMO foods or for different varieties of foods? Do people that have this preference or concern or, in fact, in some cases, abhorrence of genetically modified organisms, are they losing choice in terms of their food on their table? There is a potential for environmental impact. What the range of that potential is open to debate. There are economic impacts in terms of who controls the food system and how much food is going to cost. Scientific information and misinformation in terms of what scientists have perhaps said in the past and what regulators have said in the past in terms of assuring, for instance, the security of genetically modified organisms that are for just feed purposes. There are issues in terms of international, especially in terms of labeling, whether or not a label has to appear on a food product indicating that one of the components of that food product is genetically modified. And there are issues here in the United States and in international trade. With labeling comes traceability. Can you, in fact, trace a particular genetically modified organism throughout all of the different segments of the marketing and distribution system from farm to table, whether or not you can actually trace these particular products? There are issues as well in international and transboundary trade in terms of economic unions like the European Economic Union and global trade in terms of what is allowed and what is not allowed on a country-by-country basis. And there is an issue, too, about patenting a life form. Now, in terms of GMOs, we have several risk and risk perception challenges as we identify all of the information and misinformation that might be out there in the public arena. It has a lot to do with understanding risk and our personal acceptance and control of risk. One of the things we always talk about in toxicology is the risk assessment or safety assessment process. On a personal basis, risks that we take individually, and things like smoking or extreme sports, junk food eating, or something like riding a motorcycle are substantially different from risks that I have limited or no control over. For example, sometimes food safety or water quality or air quality issues. I can't necessarily change the quality of the air I breathe when I am a resident of Los Angeles. It's hard to rationalize these two different types of risks and our sensitivity to those risks. It's a troublesome incident when someone appears to be profiting from increasing my personal risk. So if there is a corporate influence about this, we don't think of the makers of parachutes as necessarily profiting from our risk-taking behavior or motorcycles, yet other manufacturers that we have less control over, less choice, seem to have unacceptable control and therefore potential for profit on increasing our risk. There is the conundrum of first world versus second and third world approaches to issues such as risk. If your life and livelihood is at risk at a high level on a daily basis, far more the third world or developing nation concern than, for instance, the first world concern. If you are worried about getting enough calories, period, in your daily diet due to nutritional deficiency, famine, the issue of trace genetically modified organisms in there is sometimes brought way out of context. In Africa, for example, there have been debates about the appropriate use of GMOs in food and whether genetic engineering can help a routinely undernourished population in several segments of Africa, and what the relative risks are versus the politics of GMOs. We have, in terms of our risk perception, I always like to use the example of carcinogens in coffee. And this list of 20-some-odd carcinogens in coffee, these are active carcinogens, yet it is rare to hear about somebody talking about the new coffee house down the street as a purveyor of carcinogens. This again is a risk, whether it's known or unknown in terms of coffee drinkers, but it's a risk we choose to take. Whereas in some other cases, especially when somebody is profiting by a change or an additive or an adulteration of a food product, this is perhaps a risk that we are unwilling to take. In terms of the scope of U.S. crops that are currently on the market, most soy, cotton, and canola is GMO in the United States. And so if you've had concerns about the range, this is where genetically modified biotechnology, genetically modified organisms and biotechnology have had the largest impact in the U.S. food system. About half of the field corn, which is primarily used for feed and grain, is also got some GMO component in it. The two major genetic changes in crops have been for glyphosate resistance Roundup, which is a crop herbicide and it's a resistance gene for the use of this particular chemical to kill broadleaf plants. It's an herbicide. And the other has been the incorporation of the Bt toxin, the endotoxin from Bacillus thuringiensis, a good strong insecticide against crawling insects. There's about 10,000 acres of insect-resistant sweet corn, about 1,800 acres of virus-resistant summer squash, and about 1,100 acres of virus-resistant papaya. That papaya grown traditionally as a crop in Hawaii. What we found in terms of recent history of GMOs and introduction of plants in terms of the marketplace, it's not only that we can do it, but there needs to be consumer acceptance that somehow or another the genetically modified product has an enhanced desirability in terms of the consuming public. What we've found that this has been a challenge, GMO wheat, tomatoes, potatoes have all been abandoned commercially in recent history. They still may have a future in terms of traditional challenges against traditional breeding. The possibilities in the next 5 to 10 years, we might find herbicide-resistant sunflowers, we might find canola and soybean oil, and we might find herbicide-resistant alfalfa and sugar beets. Again, trying to change various properties, whether it be the nutritional qualities or the pest control on the farm properties of these particular plants. Now, in terms of current U.S. trends, this is some data from 2005, and asking the question, if you examine the current trends in recent history, is the star of GMO crops not shining as brightly as perhaps it once won? A series of articles based on some survey from the FDA about the number of completing the voluntary consultation process in FDA over the past decade has been in a decreasing trend, as you can see on this graph. The numbers of petitions out there for GMO crops has decreased as well into single digits. Instead of a growing trend, this is a decreasing trend. In terms of U.S. regulatory review, because of enhanced scientific review need, for instance, allergenicity, enhanced public concern about the presence of GMOs in the U.S. food system, the U.S. regulatory review time between 1994 to 1999 and the past 5 years or so has just about doubled from 5.6 months to 13.6 months. And in the marketplace, time is money. And so the idea of bringing it to market, doing the sufficient tests, field plots, and then doing the appropriate reviews is a substantial investment of resources. In terms of the approved GMO crops, these are genetically engineered crop petitions approved by USDA. We saw in the early 90s an enhancement, an increase in overall numbers, and then from that point in time, a steady decline such that there was only one in the year 2004 in terms of approvals for non-regulated status. And so there is perhaps an interface here of marketplace dynamics, public consumer interest in GMOs, the potential marketability of these in terms of perhaps media representations, and also just the issue on personal and community-wide debates on the role of GMO foods in the U.S. food supply. In terms of the implications of these trends, it can be looked at perhaps in two ways. On an international basis, China and India are aggressively pursuing biotechnology and product development. There's a question in terms of the scientific community of whether or not this development will continue in perhaps less regulated nations that don't have the infrastructure and the oversight that the United States has in terms of our regulatory science agencies, that in perhaps some of those issues, cataclysmic endpoints in terms of environmental impact, human food health, gene hopping, gene transfer might be more predisposed to happen in a less regulated, less oversight environment in other countries than perhaps in the U.S. There are implications for the global environment because of this, and also for the global food system. If you look at China and India in terms of their populations, that represents a significant majority of the world's population and in terms of marketplace. They're obviously doing it for their own good, but the U.S. is perhaps struggling with its own biotechnology future. One of the implications is perhaps we are losing our grasp on food security if, in fact, disease tolerance, herbicide resistance, pest resistance is enhanced in other parts of the country, the world, and their food supply, but perhaps not ours. In terms of our own advances and controls on the interface between biotechnology and the U.S. food system, in the early years, 1975 to 1985, there was a healthy caution for recombinant DNA research. I recall the big binders of guidance and permissions and approvals if you were doing recombinant DNA research in the academic arena. A very thorough review system, huge controls in terms of not letting these transformed genes escape from the laboratory. Many of these policies and practices are still in play today. The public debate did influence policy, and it did enhance the regulatory concerns for GMOs and GMO release into the environment. Most of the concerns for some of the end products of biotechnology, the changes in food, were actually covered in U.S. food safety and environmental laws. The FFDCA, the food additive amendments, cautions against adulterated food. We did, even though this was a modern technology, we had in the amendments to the FFDCA in 1958, had the broad language that empowered regulatory action on genetically modified organisms in food. There was still the issue and debate in terms of U.S. patent law and in Congress about patenting new life forms, and this debate is ongoing. Now, in terms of the FDCA, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, it has the primary legislative authority for GMOs in food. In 402A1, we have the food adulteration statement that a food is adulterated if it contains any poisonous or deleterious substance which may render the food injurious to health. It relates to unapproved substances that are added unintentionally or intentionally by man. And so this segment of the FFDCA actually has been brought to bear in traditional breeding end products, where in fact the product might have an enhanced toxin. We'll explore one case that we referred to once before in this course about enhancing natural product toxicity, such as solanine toxin in new breeds of potatoes. Now, in terms of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act 402A1, we do regulate these poisonous or deleterious substances in addition to food adulterants. We look at pathogens, chemicals such as lead and mercury, chemicals such as organic chemicals such as PCBs or radionuclides. We do establish tolerances or action levels within FDA based on metabolic profile of a contaminant, the level of detection we might have, and the risk assessment. So example of this is lead in foods. We have action levels associated with unacceptable levels of lead in food. In the Food Additives Amendment in 1958, one of the three sets of amendments to the FFDCA, it tells us in 402A2, a food is adulterated if it contains any additive, poisonous, or deleterious substance except one that is either, and you recall this, food additives, and that's section 409, grass, generally recognized as safe, a color additive, a registered pesticide, and recall that FQPA actually gave us a Delaney Clause exemption that pesticides are not regarded as food additives, and it actually set off a chain of events to have a totally different and separate and I would say enhanced method of monitoring pesticide residues in foods from the FQPA. You have to note that in this particular legal context, that added means an intentional addition, so it would apply to a GMO unless it was exempt as an additive or as grass. Now, the question that one can raise is one of the difficult situation where we're adding something via biotechnology, such as the gene to produce BT toxin. A BT toxin is has insecticidal activity, and so what's the interface between a particular food change and its potential pesticide activity? Now, in terms of the segments of FDCA and interface with grass, a food additive or such substance that is generally recognized as safe among experts, and this is something that we've learned here in food toxicology, is done by review panels. There is a prior recognition of linkage before 1958 and for common additives in terms of the food system. We learned in our last lectures on food additives that there is a battery of testing requirements. These are Red Book, FDA Red Book testing requirements if there is to be an additive in a food product. They range from acute and chronic toxicity tests and development of all of the profiles of potential toxicity of this particular food additive based on its level of concern. This does perhaps also apply to new grass substances unless it can be defended in the petition that this is essentially a common sense food additive with a long history without any potential for toxicological concern. In terms of how we do this in the relationship, this all goes back to the quantitative relationship between dose and response and the development of NOELs and LOELs. Remember that these pieces of data are not extrapolations. These are real data points observed in clinical studies, clinical rodent studies, mice and rats typically. And I just want to make that relationship that we do a comparative toxicology analysis. We do safety factors all up the risk assessment chain to make sure that, in fact, we are protective of the human population and subpopulations within the human population. In terms of the decision process, if we have an estimated daily intake, we want to make sure that that is below any sort of calculated negligible risk intake. We do the assessment. We do a look at the natural components that might have changed in the breeding or the genetic modification processes. Look for some unintentional contaminants. Take a look at some of the added constituents and define an acceptable daily intake based on best toxicological information and food modeling. Add the safety factors, see if it's grass-related is another approach. In terms of a plant breeding example, this is a classic one that's quoted many times. And this is University of Montana, University of North Dakota, and USDA Potato Research Lab that developed a new variety of potato. Lenape is what it was called. It was for potato chips. It was submitted to the FDA for approval, but it was found that the breeding, although there were many enhanced qualities in terms of starches and ability to cook for potato chips, they found that the breed had also increased the solanine level. And again, this is traditional breeding, so it was withdrawn from introduction. The breeding successes that we have that make up a huge amount of our food system are actually a balancing act between the enhanced nutrient or agronomic characteristics of the plant versus the natural toxicant levels that might also coexist, these secondary compounds. There's an article here that's quoted at the bottom of this slide, The Growing of Grass, essentially talking about the history of plant breeding in the human food system. Now, what are the regulatory issues associated with GMO in foods? We have to open up the question of what category of food ingredients do GMO food-based varieties fit into? Do we characterize these as food additives? Are these adulterated foods, or are they recognized as safe? If we are going to have GMO foods in the food system, what are the safety criteria, the testing that we have? What are the formal protocols that need to be submitted as each petition is forwarded through the regulatory approval process? What is the concept of substantial equivalence, and how does it relate not only to the patenting of this new life form, but also to the use of this in the human food system? Another issue is, what role does the precautionary principle play? The precautionary principle, in essence, tells us that if we don't know enough, we probably shouldn't be doing it. And this has a lot to do with things like life cycle assessment, trying to model all of the potential life cycle risks of a particular scientific development. In terms of FDA policy, and this is May 29th, 1992, Code of Federal Regulations, the safety of foods derived from new plant varieties, this is the operative policy. Genetic transferred material in foods may be subject to either food additive or GRAS process. The actual DNA itself is not a concern. DNA is readily digested in the gut. But in terms of an operative policy, in terms of whether or not it's going to be regarded as a food additive or GRAS, the trigger level for toxicants is an increase greater than 10% or a decrease in nutrients of greater than 10%. The question needs to be addressed in the petition, is there a potential allergen? And we talked about proteins and how proteins can perhaps make for allergic responses. For example, if you are working with a crop and you are working perhaps with peanut genes, there is a potential for cross transfer of some particular allergen or the development of an allergen that has cross reactivity across some of the receptors in an allergic individual. This particular policy is the current working policy. There are about 50 products that have been evaluated, and U.S. District Court has upheld this policy in September 2000 ruling. The basis of the current FDA policy discusses that animal feeding studies are quite problematic. Typically, when we do animal feeding studies, we do maximum tolerated dose approaches. We try to induce disease, whether it be cancer or other sorts of negative endpoints. This is particularly difficult to do in a natural food product where the substantial equivalence suggests that the changes are significantly less than 1% of the total chemical makeup of the plant material. And so feeding this particular very low dose material in an animal study, a short-term animal study, is going to be problematic because no matter what, you're probably not going to get an outcome. In the same way that if you low-dosed traditional toxicants in rodent studies at these very low doses, you would probably not see an effect. You would be below the lowest observed, no observed limits in terms of dose response. We also find that we do need some enhanced multidisciplinary assessment based on the genomic traits. People that are experts in the potato or rice genome and the agronomic aspects of various varieties can actually be very useful in identifying any sort of concerns for different vectors of change that might arise from genetic modification. They can also tell us about the agronomic and quality analysis in terms of comparison. The allergy potential can be analyzed in terms of standard allergen analysis, and we can also obviously analyze the toxicants and nutrients that might change in the base agricultural commodity. In terms of whether or not a GMO is regarded as an additive or grass, and this is the basis of FDCA 40282, GMO food crop will need approval as a food additive if an introduced protein is different from a normal background protein. So otherwise, it would be considered as grass. An example of this, for instance, is the introduction of a fish protein into a potato for enhanced freeze tolerance in terms of growing conditions. This would be regarded as a food additive rather than a grass petition. In terms of the food safety threats associated with GMOs, there are obviously some concerns about crossing transgenic species, such as the fish antifreeze protein, Brazil nut proteins with soybean for enhanced methionine quality. There's a different set of concerns in transgenics than just adjusting the biochemical machinery. For example, enhancing a gene so that a particular vitamin output in a plant is enhanced, a particular background nutritional quality. Some of the major concerns associated with GMOs in the food have to do with allergenicity, development of allergens or potential allergens as some of the byproducts of GMO transfer. Some of these have to do with the proteins that might be significantly large, about 10 to 70 kilodalton range, size range. Proteins that are resistant to digestion are flags, as are proteins that are stable to heat processing. And when we find that the protein that is being expressed is similar in amino acid homology to various allergen binding sites, again, that's a flag for potential concern in terms of allergic response in the consuming public. These are some of the aspects of food allergy that we reviewed in a prior lecture. In terms of the regulatory or political point of view on biotech and GMO food products, the Office of Science and Technology Policy 1994, this is an executive office, suggests that we should use risk-based scientific approach rather than focusing on the crop development process. The idea being use a traditional approach to any food crop breeding development in terms of assessing its risk, enhancing nutrients, enhancing potential food toxicants, rather than just classifying these as biotech. So the idea, or at least the approach in this policy, was that GMO crops should be treated like all food development classical breeding examples. Now, in terms of how GMOs entered our food system, one of the first instances of grass ingredients in food was chymosin recombinant technology. What we essentially did, what researchers did, was to insert the gene for calf rennet into E. coli. It is now used in about 80% of the world's cheese making, and so this has had a significant impact. What we've done here actually is kind of a debatable sort of thing in terms of dietary preferences, perhaps for vegetarians or vegans. Vegetarians especially that don't like to eat meat products. Calf rennet is a meat byproduct, and so this actually makes this cheese product more vegetarian, perhaps not vegan. This particular enzyme was deemed to be grass under Code of Federal Regulations 184.1685. And in very similar circumstances to the various yeast, mold, or microbes that are already used in food development, food production. This particular molecule, had the same protein structure, so it had chemical equivalence. The impurities associated with the process were mostly removed. The organism, the E. coli bacteria strain that was used in the production, was destroyed in processing, and there was an antibiotic resistant marker that it was also destroyed in processing. And so this was essentially a cheese enzyme that was made by a totally different process. Another early genetic engineering GRAS experience was with an insoluble glucose isomerase, and this is an enzyme used to make fructose from glucose. This was GRAS approval under CFR 184-1372 in August 1996. What essentially we have here is that this particular enzyme was bound on a reactor bead surface. It doesn't go into the food. The raw materials pass in front of this enzyme, this bound enzyme, and does its conversion. It is a food processing aid. The first controversy developed when Monsanto introduced recombinant bovine somatotropin, or bovine growth hormone. And here, this was a growth hormone or milk production hormone to enhance production in dairy and cattle. This was neither GRAS, and it was not either a food additive. It was an approved new animal drug that was genetically manufactured. We then saw in the early 90s the development of the Flavor Saver tomato from Calgene out of some research developed at the University of California at Davis. They wanted food additive status for the enzyme that they had incorporated. These were Flavor Saver tomatoes, were shelf stable tomatoes with enhanced shelf stability. The FDA findings were essentially that the enzyme was introduced, was well documented. It was about 0.16 part per million. The enzyme was digested. The marker gene was easily digested. The nutrient level in this particular food product was the same. There was no changes in terms of the tomato alkaloids, and there was no need for special labeling. What we did find in Flavor Saver, and it impacted the future of Calgene, was that perhaps the market was not really ready. I remember seeing these on the market shelf. There was a curiosity, what does it taste like? This is essentially a new beast in terms of the marketplace, in terms of consumers having direct access to a genetically modified food. I think in terms of my own observations, and in fact I was in Davis, California at this time, was that the market greeted Flavor Saver with a yawn. They addressed a concern that was perhaps not significant enough in the marketplace to make a marketplace impact to get a return on their research investment. Some early FDA approvals also included a squash, a disease-resistant squash in 1994, insect-resistant potato in 1995, herbicide-resistant soybeans, these are with us today in terms of commercial production, and BT corn in 1997 for corn borer resistance. This is still with us today. In terms of the international agencies and their review of genetically modified organisms in food, the World Health Organization in 1993 pronounced that marker genes are not a safety issue. They represent 1/250,000 of the DNA consumed in our normal diet. We digest DNA sufficiently in our gut. What they found was that the safety aspects of GMO food of plant origin was essentially not a great concern in terms of overall public health. In terms of some of the pronouncements of scientists and the scientific community, there was an article in Nature Biotechnology that appeared in the year 2000 that the safety and labeling standards for foods, food ingredients, and fresh feeds should be applied regardless of the techniques used in their production and manufacture, essentially paralleling the 1994 Office of Science and Technology Policy out of the Executive Office. They go on to say that genetic engineering may actually be safer and more precise than conventional breeding in terms of controlling the overall end product and having substantial defining results and not necessarily leaving things to the less precise conventional breeding. They suggest that foods should be assessed on the basis of substantial equivalence, there's that term again, with labeling required only for GM foods that significantly differ in composition or nutritional value from their conventional counterparts. It identifies that labeling of GMO foods in the United States is a major issue. Now, what is this substantial equivalence principle that we hear about in terms of the GMO debate? This term is not in any formal FDA document. Again, it goes to include a reduction of less than 10% in key nutrients, an increase by less than 10% in a natural non-added background toxicants, the naturally occurring, typically plant toxins, that the new proteins are well characterized and they do appear in other foods. So this is not a new chemical that is not in the food system. The source of the gene is well characterized, that the need for feeding trials because of what feeding trials actually show us is questionable. There is a real concern for allergenicity. This is a lot in terms of there is a protocol in terms of developing a data set on whether or not a particular protein in a food is going to be allergic, and we need to go through those allergenicity trials to see if in fact this is going to be of concern. Allergenicity is probably represents the greatest food toxicology risk of GMO foods. In 1987, the National Academy of Sciences came out with policy statement in terms of a review of genetically modified organisms in food. The key issues that they identified that there is no evidence in current biotechnology application to foods of a unique hazard, especially when compared against conventional breeding. The risks are similar to the introduction of unmodified organisms or those modified by conventional methods. In terms of how we do identify, for instance, food products that have been modified but are only allowed by regulation in, for instance, food animal products and not in the human, the direct human food chain. The problem associated with this is that corn is sometimes corn in terms of the production cycle of farm to plate. And in terms of the transport industry, farm trucks and silos, train cars, barges, boats, train cars, and trucks that are handling one commodity one day can handle another commodity the next day. And so this yields a very large potential for contamination if, in fact, you were looking for purity of non-GMO food types. There are also analytical challenges in terms of evaluating the percent GMO. Do we do this on the farm, at a commercial silo, at a processor? Is there a potential for mixing and transport? Bulk commodities are quite often warehoused together. Do we need separate commodity warehousing for GMO foods in terms of controlling their entrance and potential impact in the human food system? There's also the cost of the testing. The food system, food production system, is a small margin industry. There's not a whole lot of farmers that are getting rich these days in farming. There's a time issue in terms of turnaround of tests. These are perishable goods. It's the same reason why perhaps we have very limited, on a statistical basis, pesticide monitoring. Don't have many sort of holdups in the whole perishable food transport system due to analytical testing. There's also an issue of sample size and reliability, statistical significance. For instance, if it's a contamination problem and perhaps 1% of a non-GMO corn is contaminated with a GMO corn product, is that contamination? So how do we test a silo of corn if in fact it's just one particular segment that has been contaminated? It's not thoroughly mixed. It's a very non-homogeneous material. There are also some problems associated with allergen analysis, the extraction. We denature many of these proteins. When we do the extraction and analysis, they'll lead us to false positives or false negatives. There is a need for specific ELISA tests, enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays. We do have some of these available for some allergens associated with major food products, but not necessarily for all of them. One of the big issues in terms of recent history, and we talked about the trust us dictum, regulators were saying that we have a mechanism in place to for food safety, and this particular incident, the BT corn, Adventus BT corn incident, or Starlink incident, actually highlighted some troubles in terms of the regulatory science associated with GMO introduction into the U.S. food system. Starlink corn has the Cry9C based BT toxin protein. This is a bacterial endotoxin for crawling worms. It actually had its approval in Federal Regulation 28258, Bacillus thuringiensis subspecies Tollworthy Cry9-6 protein, and the genetic material necessary for its production in corn. Exemption from the requirement of a tolerance. And so this gave the regulatory approval for this particular genetically modified organism in food. Now, we started having some analysis requirements in terms of EPA allergenicity evaluation. There was no known homology of the 8 amino acid sequence in this particular end product, but they also are regarding the reality that we just don't know all the different homologies of allergen receptors. They did find that Cry9C was actually resistant to digestion. This is a marker for allergenicity, and it is also stable in thermal processing, another concern in terms of allergenicity. Its molecular weight was at 68 kilodaltons, was in the upper range, and so it's a large enough protein to elicit an immune response. And thus, EPA wanted some approval, warned an approval that it may be linked to food allergy. There are other EPA arguments in terms of the risk-benefit associated with reduction in pesticides, safer agricultural practice that did allow this for approval. There is an abundance of this, there is a low abundance of this protein, but if you go into the patent, it argues that this particular protein has high toxicity. This whole toxicity issue is another issue in terms of essentially a bacterial endotoxin introduced into a food product. There is low potential for environmental exposure, but there is a question about corn dust and workplace occupational exposure of people that are around corn dust in milling operations, in silo operations, storage and transport individuals. In terms of the Starlink corn problem, what we had was Adventus was producing this particular corn with the BT toxin protein incorporated into it. Its approval was given in 1998, but it was restricted to animal feed because of the allergenic potential based on the allergenicity flag criteria. In September 2000, a consumer group, Friends of the Earth, analyzed taco shells, and they found this particular protein, the BT protein, in taco shells, essentially alerting regulatory authorities that the best case scenarios of control in the food distribution, food transport system was faced with a major breakdown. On September 11th, 2000, Friends of the Earth called on EPA to remove these particular corn products. Taco Bell, the manufacturer, begins a recall of tacos from supermarkets, and Safeway and other products made by Kraft were also recalled. On October 10th of 2000, Adventus Crop Science was declared financially responsible by EPA for this failure of control within the food distribution system, that it wasn't the farmer's fault in terms of the segregation of this feed corn from the human food corn distribution pathway. In terms of how this problem progressed, on the 18th of October in the year 2000, Kellogg shut down its Corn Flakes cereal plant. The major concern at that time was their potential for allergen and allergic response in the food products being produced at the plants. On the 19th, Adventus said the problem is that farmers commingled corn into human food destined corn, and so was trying to essentially say that it was an on-the-farm mix-up of 260 grain elevators, about 106 sent out food to food processors, which is about 12% Starlink corn, or about 9 million bushels in terms of the mix-up. In terms of newspaper accounts of the impacts for grain millers and grocers, this is from an article on October 10th of 2000. Kroger and Albertsons remove cereal and tacos, corn-based products. Mission Foods recalls all tacos, the largest U.S. maker of those. Azteca Milling takes back all its Yellow 2 corn flour products from stores. ConAgra stops operations at a Kansas corn flour mill. It does not decide to disclose its list of customers. On November 3rd, FDA announces over 300 products from their investigation had potential risk. Again, this potential risk was primarily allergenicity. In terms of some commentaries that appeared on the incident in newspaper articles, Representative Arkansas Children's Hospital says right now sensitivity to the protein is unknown. USDA and FDA and EPA says there is little risk, if any. Les Crawford from Georgetown University, who went on to become the commissioner of the FDA, was quoted as saying, it's not the human health risk that is concerning, it is that it got there in the first place. Cargill chairman W. Stanley said that the problem appears to be under control, but there was a breakdown in the process by irresponsible procedures by a few in the chain. There is a process of protocols to be followed. Unfortunately, people didn't handle things correctly. In terms of the relative risk assessment, scientists did testify to EPA about the particular risks associated with this incident and follow-up analysis. You'd probably need repeated long-term exposure. Remember that we need a sensitization followed by a secondary exposure at least to develop a food allergy. Cry9C accounts for about 0.13% of the corn grain, and in terms of scientific analysis, most allergens make up to 1 to 40% of the food. So it's a clear sort of dose response in terms of food allergy. This clearly, the quote is, would not produce protein levels of any health concern. So there was a diminishment of potential risk due to the involvement of this particular protein in the human food chain. Now moving on in terms of international and transboundary analysis and management of genetically modified organisms, the UN Secretariat of the Convention on Biological Diversity published the Cartagena Protocol in the year 2000. The major issues identified in that relative to GM, genetically modified organisms and food production were the adequacy of biosafety procedures. There was concern about the conservation and biological diversity issues related to GMOs, concerns about human health, and concerns about transboundary movement in terms of the global marketplace for food. We find that in terms of international management of food additives, that the there is an interaction between GMOs and the Codex Alimentarius. Again, this is the World Health Organization food standards. The specific documents in terms of management statements are Principles for the Risk Analysis of Foods Derived from Modern Biotechnology, published in 2003. The Guideline for the Conduct of Food Safety Assessment of Foods Derived from Recombinant DNA Plants, and that was published in 2003. And then also the Guideline for the Conduct of Food Safety Assessment of Foods Produced Using Recombinant DNA Microorganisms, and that also was published in 2003. Now, in terms of how we can explore the impacts of GMOs in another part of the world, what we're going to do next is talk about the European experience and the current kind of state of policy associated with genetically modified organisms in food for Europe. In terms of the past decade or so in Europe, this has been a harsh time for agriculture. If you recall, the BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or mad cow disease incident in the UK, there was kind of the ministry agencies of agriculture in the UK essentially tried to calm the situation down, but it did end up with 80 people dead from this particular disease. In 1999, there was a dioxin contamination in Belgium. We're going to talk about that here in food toxicology in our dioxin and related compounds lecture later this semester. It resulted in hundreds of thousands of animals being put down in a contamination of the food supply in a significant area of Europe due to dioxins and PCBs being incorporated into animal feed. The EU, the European Union, does have some concern over the lack of data, so it's invoking precautionary principle. We don't know enough, so let's not approve it. In terms of the EU and international issues, there is some food safety for in terms of the relationship of patents, international patents, labeling, regulations, and controlled are major issues in terms of transboundary movement of these products. There are big issues in terms of production agriculture, especially truck farm and smaller agricultural operations. Can there be coexistence of genetically modified and conventional crops? Are there going to be cross-pollination? Can we maintain a freedom of choice in terms of the coexistence of these two types of food products in the marketplace? Currently, for example, the United States is a major exporter, international exporter of soybeans. The EU chooses to go to South America for their soybeans as GMO-free. The European Union, in terms of policy statements, have issued several directives and regulations. They're cited on this particular slide if you want to do a little bit of research in terms of following them out, in terms of the focus of how they have attempted to manage transboundary movement, labeling, and contamination. The major themes that we find are labeling, traceability, maintaining traceability, contamination. Currently in the EU, less than 0.9%, so of a GMO in a food product is unregulated. Greater than 0.9% is regulated. And so what they're doing is identifying that there is the potential for contamination in all of the handling aspects of GMOs in the food chain. There are also some issues, again, of substantial equivalence and transboundary movement. In terms of the EUs, there are some fears that local ecosystems will be compromised, local agricultural agronomic operations will be compromised, the niche markets of developing organic products and local varieties, very popular in European agriculture, will be diminished by the introduction of super crops. Many of the member states in the EU have a temporary moratorium on the cultivation of GM crops, and they're concentrating instead on things like integrated and sustainable agricultural practices, again, by a local social or political choice. In terms of the current EU status, what we find is that there are no genetically modified products that have been approved for importation into the EU since 1998. The new stricter regulations on labeling and traceability took place in October 2003. And so this definitely has been an impediment in terms of global trade and perhaps has been one of the dynamics that's been looked at in terms of the marketplace and the influence of the marketplace on the progression of GMOs in the human food system. Well, that is essentially our introductory approach to many of the issues, the background, the science, technology, and also some of the science associated with the food additive and the management of GMOs in the human food system, especially from a food toxicology point of view. Next time, what we're going to do is talk about food processing, if you will. We'll start talking about a way to manage enhancing the food safety of food products and the shelf life of food products via a process called food irradiation. Until that time, we'll see you later. Thanks.